I was thinking as we were singing the first song tonight, and its title has escaped me now, but, oh, I need thee every hour. We've got them, don't we? We've got them right here in His Word. That is such a blessing. And we said, finished up last week, finished chapter 23, where Paul was once again whisked away by the Roman saviors, as you will, kept safe from the Jewish throngs who meant him harm. And as I think back on what I was reading and teaching there, the Sadducees and the Pharisees were kind of in contrast with each other. They believed different things. The Pharisees seemed to have a fairly basic understanding that followed Scripture, but the Sadducees didn't believe any of it. And yet it appeared that the Sadducees were the ones who were in power at the time. They must have ruled the majority. You know how the majority can sometimes take over and the minority becomes very silent. And it seems to me that it's the Sadducees primarily, or the ones who are leaning toward that, were the ones that are really after Paul because of his teaching of the resurrection. And Paul's pointed that out before, and he's going to point it out again. Now, as we get into chapter 24, I'd like to first read verses 1 through 23 and cover that initially. I've got three major sections here to discuss tonight. It doesn't look like number 2 is very big on the board, but they're all very big, so we may not get through with it tonight, but we'll pick it up next week. Chapter 24. Now after 5 days, Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus. These gave evidence to the governor against Paul. And when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, "Seeing that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight. We accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. But the commander, Lysias, came by and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. Then Paul, after the governor had nodded to him to speak, answered, "Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city. Nor can they prove the things of which they now accuse me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men. Now after many years, I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation, in the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with a tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council, unless it is for this one statement which I cried out standing among them, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged by you this day. But when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, "When Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case." So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. Okay, so we see the three parts here. We see the accusation, we see the reply or defense, pardon me, and we see the decision. You may notice on the board, I have trial, I have charges, and I have decision in quotation marks. That's kind of my way of being facetious. You may or may not agree with that, but that's how I see these things as I'm reading through here. So let's look at the trial. Who was it? Who was it who came to Caesarea? Came down to Caesarea. Again, elevation-wise, they're talking about Jerusalem, which is about 60 feet above sea level, Caesarea, which is at sea level. So that's who. That's how they came down to. Who came down to Caesarea? Anybody?
Ananias. Certain elders.
Certain elders, not all of them.
Certain elders and an orator named Tertullus.
Right. So we've got Ananias, who is the high priest, if you recall. He's the one who commanded in chapter 23 that Paul should be slapped before anybody could really even hear anything out of Paul, before he was tried for the accusations. So he's the high priest. Some are the Jewish elders. Not all of them. Again, this is where I'm kind of thinking that it's more the Sadducees who are coming along and dragging this thing along down to Felix, the governor. And they have an orator with them named Tertullus. As an orator, you might consider him an ancient version of today's modern attorney. Now, he's going to argue the charges on behalf of the Jews who are present. So what's the real charge against Paul? The real charge. Not the ones that we hear the Jews say. But what's the underlying charge against him?
Would it be that he's saying there's a resurrection?
He's saying there's a resurrection. He points that out later, and he pointed it out before, because he saw the difference between the Sadducees and the Pharisees back in 23 when he was talking to them in the before the Sanhedrin. Okay, so that's the real charge against him. But is it a valid charge? This grew out of the Jewish party rivalry and jealousy between the Pharisees, primarily the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So Tertullus is an orator, or an attorney, and he's set to argue the charges that are drummed up against by the Sadducees against Paul. He starts off with false flattery. The Jews did not like Felix. Felix didn't much care for the Jews. I don't know if it was because he was stuck there instead of back home in Rome where he'd rather be or what. But he had a pretty bad reputation among the Jews, in spite of the fact that he was charged by the Roman emperor with maintaining the peace in that territory that the Romans had annexed into the Roman Empire. It starts off with false flattery. Let me read verses 5 and 6. These are the accusations he makes. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him and wanted to judge him according to our law. We know from our study in the past that none of this is accurate, that it's been mentioned before that it's actually a compliment to Paul for the fact that he has spread the word and this dissension, so to speak, throughout all the world. If only they would have opened their Torah and the law and the prophets and studied it instead of resisting it. So his main argument has four parts. And he's presenting this to Felix, who is in charge of keeping the peace. He's presenting it in such a way as to make Paul look like he is totally against keeping the peace. In other words, presenting him as an enemy to the judge, an enemy to Felix, who's standing there in judgment. He calls him a plague, which is implying that he's deadly infectious. That's not very good. He's a creator of dissension, insurrection, revolt. No leader wants to hear that. He's charging him as a ringleader. In other words, he's in charge of this whole mess. He's the one responsible for it. You get rid of him, everything settles back down. Somebody take a look at John 1 and read John 1, 45 through 46 and get a little idea of what the ringleader of the Nazarenes means.
Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found you." Oh, wait. John 1, 45, 46.
You have the right spot.
Okay. "We have found him of whom Moses is the law, and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see."
Can anything good come out of Nazareth? The Nazarene is someone from Nazareth. That's what they're referring to here. And as you can see, early on in John's Gospel, there was a lot of, there's a bias, a certain prejudice, a bias against the people from Nazareth, from amongst the main body of the Jews, for whatever reason. I'm not that familiar with what led to that. But there is a lot of prejudice against that. So that's what he's referring to. And he's a ringleader in charge of this gang, this sect. And notice verse 6. Verse 6 says he even tried to profane the temple. Now, if you compare that to chapter 21, verse 28, you'll see that they were saying then, they were accusing him of actually profaning the temple, violating the temple by bringing a Gentile in, which was a false charge. But they've gone from saying he actually did it to he tried to do it. And in verse 7, Tertullus plays the poor me card, or poor us card, when he says that with great violence, Lysias the commander seized Paul and took him out of their midst, while all they were trying to do was triumph for his offenses against the Jewish law. If you recall, Jewish law was respected by the Romans as it applied to Jews, and the Jews could try people based upon Jewish law. When it came to capital punishment, if they found that to be the case, though, it still had to be signed off on by the Roman commander. So he says, with great violence, Lysias did this. Now, I think that if you change the word from with great violence, if you change that to say within great violence or among great violence, Lysias took him, it's a little bit more accurate. But who was causing violence? Was it the Roman commander and his troops back in chapter 21? Or was it the Jews who were getting themselves all worked up over Paul's teaching? So, in order to expedite the proceedings, Tertullus very generously invites Felix to make a quick decision in favor of the Jews, of course. And in chapter or verse 9, you see all the Jews assented. Now picture the room. As I see it, as I understand it, Felix is in the center, elevated, and the Jews are on one side, and Paul is probably all by himself on the other side or in a corner somewhere. And this gang of Jews, doesn't say how many of them, but it was probably a good number of them, were all now assenting to, you know, kind of cheering Tertullus on. That's right. I think giving Felix a little sense of, you better do something for us, Felix, because we're unhappy. But the big question is, and I think Felix saw this, and Paul points it out to him later, where is the proof? Where is the proof? So we come to Paul's defense, beginning in, or his reply, beginning in verse 10. He really didn't need to defend himself, technically, because he hadn't done anything wrong. And it just took a simple nod of Felix's head towards Paul, saying, okay, they're done, it's your turn. And Paul knew that. So he spoke. And he acknowledges Felix's authority, but without that gushing flattery that we witnessed from Tertullus earlier on in the chapter. He talks about Titus. Verse 11. If you recall, back in chapter 21, verse 15, that's when he arrived in Jerusalem. He came to Jerusalem to worship, not to incite a riot. He came to worship. Now, 12 days have passed since that time. Since that time, remember, he left Caesarea, where he is now, and went up to Jerusalem. So 7 to 8 of those days, he's been in Roman custody, hasn't he? Yes, the implication here is two things. How could I have had the time to have done all that they talk about, inciting riots, creating dissension, being a plague, that sort of thing, if all I had was 4 or 5 days in Jerusalem? And then he also invites Felix to check his alibi. Says, you know how to do it. You know how to check into it. He's right there in Caesarea too. He can check to see, find witnesses to when Paul left and how long he'd been up in Jerusalem. Okay, so now, point number two. That was timing. Point number two was he was not found in the temple to be disputing or inciting. Anybody recall what he was doing when the Jews in Asia found him in the temple and grabbed a hold of him?
No.
Something to do with purification? Remember when he'd come up to Caesarea, the Jewish elders wanted help from him to appease the local Jews, because he said the Jews were saying that you don't obey the law, you don't have anything to do with Moses and all that stuff. We want you to show you obey the law by being part of this purification process yourself, because you've been out among the Gentiles, so that you can go into the temple and support these men that we have, these Jewish Christians that we have, who have taken a vow. The assumption was it was a Nazarene, not Nazarite. It was a Nazarite, not a Nazarene vow. I think that's the way it went. And apparently they were asking Paul to pay for or provide for the sacrifices that were necessary at the end of this vow, which was all under Jewish law. The complication here is that Paul knew they were no longer under the law. He had already written about that. But he is trying to appease the Jews. He's trying to appease his brethren, the elders who are in charge of the church there in Jerusalem, and out of respect for them, and in an attempt to make good, if you will, with the Jews, he agrees to go along with this. We had a discussion about this a few weeks back, and we talked about, was Paul still engaging in sacrifice? Was Paul still engaging in the Jewish traditions and that sort of thing? And there are a lot of good opinions floating around on that. But what it boils down to is this. Did Paul ever get an opportunity to engage in a sacrifice at that event? No. He was stopped by the Jews. So God used him. God uses the Jews from Asia to stop him from engaging in the sacrifice. It's something more to think about. He was never able to go beyond the purification stage. He had purified himself outside the temple for a series of days and went into the temple then to approach the priest to talk about the sacrifices, bringing the sacrifices for these men who he was with. And he had been purified according to Jewish law. So there's no proof. What he does admit to now is, is to being a follower of the way, which his accusers call a sect, if you recall. He uses the word sect here, S-E-C-T, and his accusers, his Tertullus, use the word sect. Now, Paul in no way, shape, or form condones the use of the word sect or Nazarene as a description of the Christian church. There is no biblical, no scriptural permission for doing anything like that. And yet we see it on some church signs here and there, as far as Nazarene goes. The New King James and the American Standard Version use the word sect, and the King James Version uses the word heresy, which is essentially a definition of sect. This implies a division or a split away. What they're trying to show is that what the Jews are trying to show is that he, Paul, and his followers of the way are trying to split off from the Jewish tradition and Jewish law. And he, of course, is denying that. That's not obviously not what Christianity is. It's a continuation of God's plan, not a split off from the Jewish law. Christianity is, in fact, grounded in law, right? Grounded in the law and the prophets. Would somebody look at Galatians 3, verses 24 and 25, and read that for us, please? Galatians 3, 24 and 25.
Therefore the law was our Torah to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under the Torah.
Okay, so the law was our tutor, right? It was teaching us. It was giving us an idea of things to come. But as we are now under Christ, we no longer have a need for that tutor, for that law. Certainly principles of that law applied and still apply today, but only as the New Testament dictates it.
Yeah.
So Paul talks about the resurrection again. And he points out, like the Jews, he has hope in God, which is the resurrection of the dead. And he very specifically says, resurrection of the dead, both the just and the unjust, in verse 15. Okay? I'd like to take a little break here from Acts and make a couple of points about the resurrection. There are certain issues regarding the resurrection, different beliefs that people have, even though they call themselves Christians. There's going to be one resurrection. The resurrection of both the good and the evil. Paul just told us that here. Would somebody pick up John 5? Turn to John 5, verses 28 through 29, and see what that says. See what Jesus tells us.
Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the grave will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation.
All who are in graves, all the dead, to the resurrection of life. Was it resurrection of life and the resurrection of condemnation? Is Jesus saying the same thing here that Paul said? Who taught Paul? So it's a consistent message. But there are people out there who believe that there's this alleged 1,000-year reign, a reign of Christ that will be coming. And at the beginning of that 1,000-year period, the righteous will be resurrected. And at the end of the reign of Christ, a second resurrection will occur in which the wicked will be resurrected. Does that have any biblical ground here? Those are the millennialists. So millennialism is refuted right here with Paul, what Paul said and what we just read in John 5. And the Pharisee notion about resurrection is refuted here by one, none other than one of their own students, right? Paul was raised a Pharisee. But the Pharisees believed that there'd only be one resurrection, and that would be for the... They believed in one resurrection, but they believed that it would be a resurrection of the righteous. Only the righteous. Nothing to do with the evil. In other words, what from that, what would you gather? What would punishment be if there's no resurrection of the evil? Would they just lay in their graves for all eternity? That's not what Paul says. That's not what Jesus says. And there's a thing called realized eschatology, which I always have trouble pronouncing, and always have trouble when I see it remembering, what does that mean? Realized eschatology. E-S-C-H-A-T-O-L-O-G-Y. You may have heard of it before. But that's refuted here. They believe that the references to resurrection are merely a reference to the resurgence of Christianity after a period of Jewish persecution. Where is that in the Bible? Again, it's proven, it's shown here. Paul says it, and Jesus said it. One resurrection, both the just and the unjust will be raised and judged according to their works. So all three of these errors that I've just pointed out, like most, probably stem from an incomplete study of the Bible, a study that does not study the context of the verses. You pick a verse and you make it mean something. You pick a verse and you make it fit into your doctrine. You don't study God's whole word. But in backing up to what Paul said, Paul says there'll be a resurrection, one resurrection. The evil, in his case he said, the just and the unjust. It's no wonder the Sadducees didn't want to believe in resurrection. Because if you don't believe in the resurrection, then you don't believe in punishment. You don't believe in consequences for your deeds. So, have fun. Right? So, verse 16, Paul goes on to say that because of the promise, or he says the promise, but I'm also thinking the threat of resurrection, the resurrection to judge the just and the unjust, there are consequences for your actions. Now, Paul says he strives. You notice he says he strives. I think King James and ASV, American Standard Version, say that he exercises his conscience. He exercises to have a conscience without offense toward God and man. If you're exercising, does anybody here ever exercise without doing anything? Without making an effort? Has anybody here ever exercised? It takes effort.
Yeah, you're talking.
Oh, I look in the mirror. It takes effort to strive. It takes effort to exercise. It takes effort to do that. It takes effort to have a conscience. Conscience is a real thing. And it requires serving God with diligence. And it requires serving man with the same diligence. Not as the same, but doing it in the same attitude, in the same manner, and according in being consistent with God's will. So Paul points out in verse 17 his purpose for being in Jerusalem in the first place. Was his purpose to cause problems, or was his purpose benevolence? He came to worship. He came bearing alms and offerings to his nation. What does he mean by his nation? Anybody care to venture who we mean here? Anybody have an opinion?
He was a Jew, so.
Pardon me?
He was a Jew.
He was a Jew.
So he was a nation would be the Jewish nation.
Okay. A nation is an assembly of people, a country of people. It's the people of a country, put it that way. And it's easy. There's all sorts of comments on this, going from one extreme to the other, like there are on most points in the Bible. But he's talking about his people. Who are his people now, at this part in his life?
Christians.
He's a Jew. He's a Jewish Christian. He's a Christian, right? So I kind of lean toward the fact that he has come there for the sake of all his people. He's come there to help the Christians, the Jewish Christians he knows best, to help them. But he's bringing alms and offerings. Are we supposed to just come here on Sunday and make sure we're all taking care of each other and check up on each other throughout the week and that sort of thing? Or what if we see somebody along the side of the road who's had an accident maybe, something like that, or somebody who's destitute, somebody who's having trouble clothing themselves, somebody we know as a neighbor who has had a fire, but none of them assemble with us on a Sunday? Are we supposed to ignore them? That's what Paul is proving here. That's what Paul is pointing out. He's come to minister to his people. And by ministering to the Jews, then he's trying to soften their hearts. He's trying to win them by softening their hearts through an example of generosity towards all. I see a couple of hearts softening here. Would somebody read Galatians 6:10, please? Galatians 6:10.
Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith.
Let us do good to all. The second part of that verse proves that the first part of that verse means all without exception. Because he points out, okay, yeah, we want to make sure everybody who's in Christ is taken care of too. But we want to take care of everybody else that we can take care of along the way. Any other thoughts or questions on that? Okay, we have just a couple minutes. Okay, so he talks about in 18, we talked about it before, that his defense is, or his reply is, in the middle of his work, following his purification, according to the law, he was accused by some Jews from Asia, and he asked the question, his fourth point, where are they? Where are they? I don't have it on the board. Nope. Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19. Somebody please read. Get that highlighted in order. Deuteronomy 19, verses 15 through 20. This is the Jewish law.
One of the witnesses shall rise against a man concerning all iniquity or any sin which he commits, that he commits by the mouth of two or three, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. If a false witness arises against any man to testify against him a wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days, and the judges shall make careful inquiry. The witness is a false witness, he is, who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you. And those who remain shall hear, and hereafter they shall not commit such an evil among you.
All right. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, in other words, not just one, this is the Jewish law. Are the Jews doing this? Have they brought any witnesses? They don't have any eyewitnesses with them. Not one person has stood up there and offered eyewitness testimony, have they? So by Jewish law, They're totally off base here. And by the Roman principle of law at that time, the Roman principle of that law was that you were to face your accusers. And that hasn't even happened here. Interestingly, Felix hasn't brought it up, but Paul certainly did. So Paul goes on to say, surely those who are here now have investigated this matter, have investigated my defense before the Sanhedrin earlier in chapter 23. What'd they find out? And nobody responds. And in verse 21, he again points out it's about the resurrection, isn't it? This is the real deal, the real charge against Paul, as false as it is. And so he closes his statement and says, it's about Jewish law, not Roman law. So why am I here? And of course, Felix's decision, another one of my quotation marks, Felix's decision is, we're going to wait. And we'll get into a little bit more detail the next time. Anybody have any questions or comments along the way? So next week we'll start here.